actually one of the founders of the New York Marxist School, now the Brecht Forum. And I'm very pleased to introduce Kevin Anderson, who teaches sociology at the University of California in Santa Barbara. I think we need to do something. Is there anyone who could do something about the ringing or humming? Let's see. Thanks so much. So Kevin teaches sociology at the University of California in Santa Barbara. The title of his talk tonight, Marx at the Margins, is the title of his book, which will be out early next year and is being published by the University of Chicago. I look forward to that. There are lots of handouts here. Well, two, but many copies of them. Would someone be kind enough to... Thank you. So Kevin has been nice enough to give us a rundown of his talk here, and then a sheet on who are the Marxist humanists. Kevin wrote the Rosa Luxemburg Reader. He's co-editor with Peter Udis. And he wrote some time ago, Lenin, Hegel, and Western Marxism, which I myself found an absorbing and very important book. So without further ado, Kevin Anderson.
Hi, is the sound on at all? Is the microphone on at all or no? Yeah, or no. Okay, because I have a pretty soft voice. Oh, okay, good. What's going around are two things. The first one is, I don't have PowerPoint. I don't know if this place has it either, but it's just like it'll help you to follow some of the points in my talk. And then the other one is a sheet about a website that a lot of my writings appear on. This talk may even appear on that website in a little while, as well as some other writings related to my book. Now, what you're going to get tonight is an exploration of some of the issues in the book Marx at the Margins, and so it'll try to look at it as a whole briefly, and then afterwards whatever issues people are interested in we can explore in greater detail. Okay, despite the revival of interest in Marx, especially since the economic crisis hit a couple years ago. Despite that, as we all know, or the room would be much larger, that conceptual barriers continue to block what I think would be a very positive step, returning to Marx as the primary source of leftist critique of modern capitalism and of modern society as a whole, and also for the battle for change. In this sense, I think what Jean-Paul Sartre said several decades ago still holds validity, which is that as long as we live under capitalism, Marx will still be an essential thinker to look at, and we won't be able to really transcend his critique of political economy until we transcend capitalism. But in the last few decades, especially since maybe the 1980s, there's been a lot of critique of Marx, a lot of discussion of Marx being dead, or Marxism being dead. And they fall into two main sets of critiques. One, of course, is the familiar neoliberal critique that Marx is a dead dog because he tried to take us beyond capitalism, to which there is no alternative. And the experiment of the Soviet Union failed, or it is said as part of this critique, thus invalidating at an empirical level, at a factual level, Marx's supposedly impractical and utopian schemes for society, for socialism. But most of us don't, I doubt too many of the people here travel in those circles. So the circles we travel in, a different kind of critique of Marx appears in progressive academia, in the intellectual left. And this critique of Marx has taken a second, fairly different direction, although with some overlap. Here it is said very often that the problem with Marx is not that he was too radical, but that he was not radical enough. Some add that the truly radical thinkers are people like Michel Foucault, Gilles Deleuze, even Friedrich Nietzsche. These critics, most famously Edward Said, author of Orientalism, attack Marx for adopting what they see as a unilinear model of development in the modernist mode. Postmodernists have termed this the grand narrative. Here, much of the debate has revolved around Marx's early articles on India and China during the early 1850s, and also in the Communist Manifesto of 1848, a passage on China. At a more general level, it is said even more often among progressives that Marx informs us about class and economic structures and economic crises, but that his theoretical model does not incorporate race, ethnicity, or nationalism at all, or at least not very much, or not very successfully. So I think responding to these critiques, especially the one coming from the progressive left, is very important. I think it's as important as the earlier effort to separate Marx's original vision from Stalinism and other forms of totalitarianism. And that effort is still necessary today, but those questions have kind of faded. Now, we inhabit a culture saturated with negative images of Marx, even on the left to an extent, and it's therefore impossible to approach his writings for the first time without being affected by some of the definitions already in place from the critics. And in this presentation, I want to mention and respond to the types of criticism of Marx that have been coming from the progressive left and which center on charges of unilinearism and grand narrative, and which also which argue that Marx is burdened by ethnocentrism and lack of concern with race, ethnicity, can't conceptualize, it said, issues like nationalism very well. And here we should, before getting into Marx's writings, I want to talk for a second about Marx's life, because the title of my book comes out of this notion of Marx being at the margins. Marx himself lived at the margins. And his thought is, of course, relegated to the margins so often. And the deconstructionist philosopher Jacques Derrida captured this very well in his book on Marx about 15 years ago. He wrote that he noted that Marx lived as a political refugee in Victorian London, and Derrida linked this to his equally marginal position within the Western intellectual tradition as follows. Marx remains an immigrant among us, a glorious, sacred, accursed, but still clandestine immigrant, as he was all his life. So part one of this talk is called Marx and the Non-Western Other, India, China, and Russia. I think I want to acknowledge at the beginning that Marx's critics do have a point in terms of some of his early writings on India and China. Marx begins with a somewhat modernist and unilinear perspective toward China and India, but moves gradually toward a more multilinear and multicultural approach toward India and other non-Western societies in the following years and decades. As Edward Said and other critics have noted repeatedly, Marx's 1848 to 53 writings on India and China exhibit Orientalist notions of modernity, occasionally accompanied by ethnocentric ones, in which European colonialism is portrayed as a necessary stage on the road towards social development for societies trapped in an unchanging traditionalism. He begins to alter this perspective, I will argue, in the late 1850s, particularly in the Grundrisse, and in his writings on anti-colonial resistance in India and China. By the time of his late writings, 1879 to 82, some of them still unpublished, Marx has moved toward a more anti-colonialist position and a more multilinear approach to social development in which certain pre-modern social forms, especially communal property, are seen as now as building blocks for an alternative form of modernity. So let's trace some of this evolution, but beginning with some of the problematic, more problematic part at the beginning. The Communist Manifesto, as is well known to Marx's critics, Marx and Engels write famously in praise of Western capitalism penetration of Asia, of its, quote, battering down of all Chinese walls and of its drawing even the most barbarian nations into civilization. This is in the first few pages of the Communist Manifesto. Here Marx and Engels seem, one, to view Western colonial incursions into Asia, including India, England's first opium war against China of 1839-42, as on the whole progressive and beneficial in that they undermine Oriental barbarism, as they called it, and brought modernization in its wake. Second, they assume that the rest of the world would sooner or later follow in the footsteps of the more technologically advanced Western European nations, especially Britain. You could picture it as a train, if you wanted to, with Britain in the lead car, and then these other societies way in the back being dragged along into the future. Marx and Engels praise this early stage of capitalist globalization in the manifesto. In a way, I think it can be seen as part of their overall sketch of the achievements of capitalism in Western Europe and North America, which you also find on the first pages of the Communist Manifesto. Now, in that case, when they're talking about modern capitalism, it's followed by a withering critique of capitalist exploitation, of its incessant economic crises that call its very existence into question, and so forth. But when they get to India and China, they don't follow the praise of colonialist progress with a critique of that sort in the Communist Manifesto. It's just kind of left hanging. Instead, they hold to an implicitly unilinear model of development in which China and India would become like Europe eventually, and then they would have these contradictions and they would be able to progress in a more positive socialistic manner. Now, Marx continues these themes, and now it's Marx alone, in the writings around 1853 for the New York Tribune. And in some passages, of course, Marx evokes notions of an independent India shaking off the chains of British colonialism. But even here, there's still the notion that India has to be modernized along Western European lines, and that this is inevitable. Moreover, Marx's portrait of Indian culture and society is so condescending that it's painful in the 21st century to quote some of it. So I want to just give you a sense of this. Here, following Hegel, he describes India as an unchanging society that lacks any real historical development except, he says, those introduced by its conquerors, whether the Arabs and the Persians or later the British. In the face of these conquerors, he writes, India proved to be an unresisting and unchanging society. And he does not mean that as a compliment. The roots of this are said to lie in India's economically self-contained villages, which stifled individual development and social progress. In fact, Marx portrays the communal structures of these traditional villages as, quote, the solid foundation of Oriental despotism. While he also begins to attack what he calls the barbarism of British colonialism, in other words, here it's a equal opportunity barbarism, both the British and the Indians are barbaric in different ways, he still views colonialism as bringing about necessary if painful progress through modernization in a rather unilinear fashion. 4 years later, in 1857, he begins to shift his position on India and China. By 1857, the anti-British Sepoy uprising broke out in India, which led to 2 years of conflict in which the British almost lost control of the subcontinent. Marx enthusiastically supports the uprising, noting that the rebellious Sepoy troops, who were British-trained Indian soldiers, that's what we're talking about here, were themselves a product of British colonialism, and he does so in a typical kind of dialectical formulation. He writes, there is something in history like retribution, and it is a rule of historical retribution that its instrument be forged not by the offended, but by the offender himself. And for the next 2 years, Marx continues to write in the New York Tribune, and he and Engels describe the Sepoy uprising and its brutal suppression by the British. And he In fact, not only does he celebrate the Indian uprising, but he contrasts it to the relative quiet in Europe with the labor movement and the socialist movement at that time. And he writes to Engels that with the collapse of the labor and socialist movement in Europe in the late 1850s, India is now our best ally. In other words, the best source of rebellion and possibly revolution against the global system. By this time, he has assumed a more anti-colonialist position, of course. Marx has also shifted his attitude toward China by this time, strongly supporting the Chinese during the Second Opium War, which is 1856 to 1860. And this begins with one of these kind of things where supposedly a British flag was taken on a ship, so therefore they basically pulverized the city of Guangdong, or Canton, as it was called in English then. When Marx writes, the unoffending citizens and peaceful tradesmen of Canton have been slaughtered, their habitations battered to the ground, and the claims of humanity violated on the flimsy pretense that English life and property are endangered. These sweeping assertions are baseless. The Chinese have at least 99 injuries to complain of to one on the part of the English. So as with India, Marx has moved toward a more anti-colonialist position by, this is 1856-57, with China. Now this is the same period, 1857-58, that Marx composes the Grundrisse, the Foundations of Political Economy, it's sometimes called, and also his first published book, with his Critique of Political Economy, The Critique of Political Economy, 1859. Now, these books contain a revision or reworking of his earlier conceptualization of three successive modes of production: Greco-Roman or slave-based, number one, medieval European or feudal, number two, and modern bourgeois mode of production, number three, based on free wage labor, formerly free wage labor. Now, referring mainly to India by now, Marx inserts another mode of production alongside these. He calls that the Asiatic mode of production. And what he suggests here is that pre-capitalist Asian societies were on a different trajectory than the European development from the ancient Greco-Roman slave-based society to the feudal mode of production. And from then on, Marx contests the notion that we can use the word feudal in some kind of uniform sense for pre-modern, pre-capitalist societies. He confines that to Western Europe pretty much from then on. Also, while he talks about Asiatic societies and their structures here, he's less negative. I mean, he certainly continues to be critical, and he doesn't become a romantic, he doesn't want to go to India and become a Hindu or anything like that, or a Buddhist. But he is more appreciative of these societies and their cultures and civilization. And also, he says that this communal property and communal structure of the village could take either a democratic or a despotic form. So this idea of Oriental despotism that he had in the early 1850s and in the Communist Manifesto seems to be, it doesn't seem as pronounced. Now, Marx picks up and develops these threads of argument about a decade later. In the 1860s, he doesn't really write much about this kind of stuff, but in the 1870s, he starts to. And there's three strands of his writing in the 1870s. The first of these is the changes he introduces in the French edition of Capital, which is the second or third edition, depending on how you look at it, of Capital Volume 1. Was not a German edition, but a French edition. And there's some parts of that that never made it into the standard English, or until very recently, German editions of Capital. And one of these quotes that's actually been used to attack Marx in the English-speaking world reads as follows. Talking about the pre-capitalist societies of England and Western Europe and how they were torn apart by capitalism. This is a process called the primitive accumulation of capital. And so Marx writes, the expropriation of the agricultural producer of the peasant from the soil is the base of the whole process. He's talking about the way the peasants were driven off the land, agriculture consolidated into large commercial farms, peasants driven off eventually to become the urban working classes or the immigrants to places like the United States or Australia or the Caribbean. Only in England, which we therefore take as an example, has it the classic form, he writes. So this phrase classic form is in there, and people have interpreted that Marx thinks in more or less a cookie cutter fashion that India or Russia, these societies that were then outside the orbit of capitalism, he's saying they're going to follow the same pathway, that they have to inevitably follow the same pathway. But in the French edition, this passage reads differently. It had time to alter it, think about it more, clarify it, whatever. So he writes the following. Expropriation of the peasants, he repeats that part. Then he writes this. England is the only country where this has been carried through completely. All the countries of Western Europe are going through the same development. So it's very explicit there, qualifying it to Western Europe, this kind of development of tearing the peasants off the land. He's taking an open position as to what's going to happen in the rest of the world. Okay. The second strand in the late writings, we're talking now the 1870s and early 1880s, he dies in 1883, concerns Russia. In several texts, Marx examines anew the issue of Russia, whether Russia and the other agrarian empires of Asia were destined to modernize in the Western manner. There's an 1877 letter responding to a criticism of capital in Russia where the critics had said, you know, Marx is assuming that Russia has to go through these same steps as in the West, and we don't agree with that. And then some of his supporters were saying, no, we agree with Marx. We do have to go through all those same steps. So Marx was actually more pissed off in a way at his supporters than his critics. And so he wrote this letter clarifying his position where he said that he denied that he had developed a historical philosophical theory of the general course fatally imposed upon all peoples. That is not what he had done in Capital, but that he had limited it to Western Europe. And he quotes that sentence there from that I just quoted to you from Capital. Now there's another letter that's even more famous, which is to the Russian revolutionary Vera Zazulich. And again, Vera Zazulich asks him explicitly, is Russia destined to be swept onto the pathway of capitalist development that was already taking place in Western Europe? Again, Marx concludes that alternate pathways of development might be possible. He bases his judgment in large part on the marked differences between the social structure of the Russian village, which is still pre-capitalist, with its communal property, and the village under Western feudalism, which had to a great extent more individualized property relations. There were also other features of society that were quite different from that of the Russian peasant. He's learned Russian by this time, and he says that his studies of Russian society had, quote, convinced me that the commune, this communal structure in the village, is the fulcrum for a social regeneration in Russia. Now, he writes a lot of drafts of these letters, too, and one of them, he says, well, what about India? That maybe there's some relationship to India, maybe there isn't. In any case, these kind of communal structures were no longer common in Western Europe, even in the feudal period. And then he and Engels write a preface to the Communist Manifesto in 1882. It's his last published writing, as far as I'm aware. And there he says that the communal social formations of Russia are not only interesting, not only could Russia have different social development, but resistance based on these villages to modernization, to capitalist modernization, could be the starting point for a communist revolution at an international level if it could link up with the revolutionary labor movement of the Western capitalist countries. Now, these are all like small texts, like a few sentences in the French edition of Capital, a few letters and so on toward the end of his life. But here's like the biggie in terms of quantity, his notebooks. Marx is spending a good part of the time in the last 5 or 6 years of his life writing notes on studies by other authors of India, Indonesia, Algeria, Egypt, Latin America, and other societies that we might call part of the global south or pre-capitalist societies. And some of these notes have yet to be published in any language, and I'm part of the group that's editing them, although a lot of them have been published, although they're not in like widely circulated editions. Now, one of the books that Marx annotates heavily in this period is a young Russian anthropologist book called Communal Land Ownership, which was published in Russian in 1879. And Marx's Russian is good enough by this time that he's like, you know, reading this whole thing, he takes like, it's going to be a couple hundred pages when it's published. these a couple hundred pages typed double spaced anyway, these notes. And then there's another book in English, Robert Sewell's Analytical History of India. Now, these notes on just on India alone, I mean, India in those days comprised the whole subcontinent, what we call Pakistan and Bangladesh. That had not, those divisions had not occurred. So talking about India as a whole, that subcontinent, these are 90,000 words. So this is like the size of a book. This is not like some small letter or something like that. Now, most of it is his summary and copying out of passages from these books. It's not his own words, but he does put his own words in, and I'm going to quote some of them. Now, in these notes on Kovalevsky's book, Marx examines social relations, especially in terms of communal property, across the entirety of Indian history, from the very early period to the period of the Muslim conquest during the European Middle Ages, to that of British colonialism beginning in the 17th century. And Marx closely follows Kovalevsky's historical typology of communal forms in rural India, and he sees several stages of development within these communal forms, that the early ones were organized around kinship groups, but then later on it just was based on whether you were a resident of the village or not. And this a similar process had taken place in Russia. And Marx also writes of social antagonisms, because once you get out of the kinship model and then you have the village-based one, it becomes a question of defining who is and isn't in the village and all these kinds of things and what people's shares are. And so there's social antagonisms and conflict. So it would certainly appear, although he never says so, I think one can read these notes as suggesting that India, he no longer saw India as an unchanging society without any history, as he had written in 1853. That was one of his big criticisms. Now, another aspect of Marx's notes on Kovalevsky deal with the impact of Muslim rule on these earlier social relations, because Muslim conquer, Arab, and then later Persian conquerors keep coming in. So what is that relationship? And anyway, in this part where he's talking about the Muslim, the Mughal Empire, the largest and most the longest of these empires, here he rejects. Not only does he not use the term feudal, because in the Grandarista he doesn't use the term feudal, but he doesn't attack the use of the term feudal to describe this society. Here he attacks Kovalevsky for using the term feudal to describe pre-capitalist, pre-imperialist, or pre-British India. Now, he appreciates Kovalevsky for a lot of things, because Kovalevsky is very critical of colonialism. And as Marx is talking about the period of the British, he goes back into the Sepoy Rebellion again. He talks about Cornwallis, who we know from US history as the general of the British armies, but the British didn't like fire him after that. They sent him over to India, where he did something really horrific, which is during his governor generalship, they developed what they called the permanent settlement, where they created Western-style capitalist property in the villages. And one of the results of that was the peasants started getting dispossessed, because when they couldn't pay their debts to the moneylenders or landlords, then they said, oh, you can't pay, well, kick you off your land, we'll sell your land. But in pre-British India, land could not be freely bought and sold in that way. So capitalist relations of private property were introduced and people were fleeced out of their land. He calls the British dogs, asses, oxen, blockheads, and so forth, alludes to a general hatred of the British government, celebrates the Sepoy uprising again, and he discerns. He says that even though these things have been broken up in the villages by Cornwallis's reorganization of agriculture and land ownership, still, among these atoms, because society is becoming atomized as under Western capitalism, still, he says, among these atoms, certain relationships endure from a distance reminiscent of the earlier landowning groups of the communal village. And that's Marx's own remark. So this suggests a link between the notes on India and the writings on Russia. If these communal relationships endure, might they not also serve as points of resistance to capital and to imperialism? Marx answers this by indicating that it was not so much the preservation of these forms as their forceful dissolution and disruption in the name of economic progress that could unleash new social forces dangerous to British rule. So it's the disruption and the masses of people being thrown out of work and into very harsh or very harsh work conditions that creates a crisis that could become a danger. And of course, there was this crisis of the sepoy uprising in 1857. Now, Marx also looks, as I mentioned, the analytical history of India, which is more about political and military developments, all the different conquerors marching through, and so forth. And here, it's strongly suggested by Marx's remarks and a selection of material that he no longer saw India as a society without a history, and he also no longer saw India as an unresisting society. So again and again, in these notes on Sewall's History of India, Marx's notes emphasize the contingent character of the Muslim and British conquests, rather than as in 1853, the ineluctable march of large historical forces. In 1853, almost was like India was destined, you know, to be taken over by, you know, more advanced society. He kind of uses that kind of language. Here, at every stage, he highlights indigenous Indian resistance to foreign conquest and how, in many cases, the conqueror succeeded just by a thread, and it could have gone in the other direction. Here's an example. He talks a lot about the Marathas, based around the area that's now Mumbai or Bombay, as it was called. A Mughal emperor, Aurangzeb, in 1704, this is one of the last important Mughal emperors before the British really took over everything. So he's getting into wars with the Marathas, who are an Indian resistance group based in the Hindu community. So here's what Marx writes in his notes. 1704, in the last 4 years of his life, whole government disorganized. Marathas began to recover their forts and gather strength. A terrible famine exhausted the provisions for troops and drained the treasury. Soldiers mutinous over want of pay. Hard-pressed by the Marathas, Emperor Aurangzeb retreated in great confusion to Ahmadnagar. So this is how he writes about 1704. In another description of the Marathas, Marx uses the word clan ancestor in a description of Maratha leadership, thus highlighting the notion that the Marathas, who formed the most important locus of Indian resistance to the Mughals and later to the British, were organized on a clan basis. None of the above is meant to suggest that Marx's notes on India are anti-Muslim. Because he does celebrate our resistance to Muslim conquerors. But at one point, he writes about the greatest Mughal emperor, Akbar, who Marx writes, made Delhi into the greatest and finest city then existing in the world. And he portrays Akbar in a relatively secular light, characterizing him as indifferent in religious matters and therefore tolerant of all religions. Marx devotes the bulk of the notes on Sewall's History of India to the period of British ascendancy, where he stresses, as I mentioned, the contingent character of Britain's conquest and the many instances where its power in India hung by a thread. He frequently terms the British blockheads or dogs, whom he sometimes describes in rather graphic language as terribly frightening, shitting in their pants at one point in the face of Indian resistance. Throughout these notes, Marx shows a pronounced sympathy for the Marathas, this Hindu-based resistance movement, while occasionally expressing disdain for their warlordism. And he doesn't see them as like a positive alternative in terms of their political structure. And the notes on Sewall suggest that Marx's sympathy for the sepoy uprising had only increased in the last 20 years. Okay, the second part of my talk, which is much briefer, I want to look at another aspect of the book, which deals more with modern Western societies of Marx's time, the American Civil War, Poland and Ireland. Well, Poland, not a modern Western society, but occupied by two modern, fairly modern societies, Austria and Prussia, in addition to Russia. Okay, now, Marx and Engels were always concerned with Poland and with, as most progressives, Democrats and socialists of that time, Poland was like one of the chief causes throughout the whole 19th century. In other words, in France once there was a revolutionary uprising and they started saying, down with the king, and then they said, Viva la Polonia. That was just like a slogan that would like come to people's lips. Because Poland was a country that had been basically destroyed in the late 18th century, and the Poles were fighting to reestablish their country. Now, a lot of people know the phrase in the Communist Manifesto that says the workers have no country, and people that interpret that as that Marx had no consideration or understanding of nationalism. But in fact, if you go to the demands of the communists at the end, which a lot of people don't read all the way to the end, it says, we support the progressive part of the Polish national movement, the part that believes in confiscating the land of the aristocracy of part as part of the fight for Polish independence. And later on, in the 1850s, Marx writes to Engels that support for Poland or lack thereof is a litmus test for the revolutionary movement. And once the First International gets started in the 1860s, one of his biggest fights with the followers of Proudhon, the anarchist utopian socialist, is over Poland, because the Proudhonists, in addition to other problems that Marx saw with them, were sympathetic to Russia rather than Poland. They're also unsympathetic to the idea that the workers' movement should take up these political causes that weren't directly related to labor questions, like Polish independence. And to the end of his life, Marx is noting this kind of thing. He notes, for example, that in the Paris Commune, some of the important military leaders were Polish, because the Poles had so much experience, military experience, with all these uprisings and so on. Okay, the Civil War in the United States is another way of glimpsing Marx's views about nationalism and ethnicity, his writings there. Now, as I mentioned before, Marx wrote for the New York Tribune, which was a left-liberal, anti-slavery newspaper whose progressiveness puts the stand of the New York Times today to shame. I mean, they really were a progressive newspaper, and they published Karl Marx. And people often think that, well, they only published like stuff that didn't talk about capitalism or workers' uprisings. No, he talked about all that kind of stuff, and it was published in the Tribune. Now, as the Civil War got underway in Britain, the working class tended to support the union side, but the aristocracy and other social groups that were quite powerful supported the South, partly for economic reasons, the cotton coming from the South. But that's over. Marx thought that was overrated, because grain was also coming from the North. But it was more like don't forget, U.S. was the only even semi-democratic country in the world at that time. They were the typical article in the London Times in the 1860s would say, yeah, you know, the U.S. is breaking apart. It shows this idea of Republican form of government. It just doesn't work. And thank God we have a monarchy where very few people can actually vote. That would be a typical kind of thing you'd read in the conservative British press. There was also attempts to intervene. There was an incident with a British ship that was stopped, and some Confederate officers were taken off that ship, and so on. And so this was a violation of Britain. Imagine like if Nicaragua once had taken stopped the American ship. So there was that kind of reaction. And so during those periods, British workers held huge public meetings where they said they didn't want any intervention on the side of the South. And the conservative propaganda said, you know, if we intervene in the war, help the South remain independent, the cotton will start flowing again, and you'll go back to work. Because the Civil War created an immediate depression in the factories of Britain, which were heavily, at that time, clothing and textile. So these public meetings, workers would pass resolutions saying that even if the cost of not being able to go back to work right away, they did not want the South to win the war, and there should be no intervention by Britain, and they supported the Northern cause. And Marx's writings, he talks about this, but he's also constantly critical of Lincoln for temporizing, for not really wanting to wage the war seriously, for not wanting to say initially that the slaves are going to be freed, for not wanting to use black troops, and so on. And Marx is talking about the possibility of a slave revolution. Like, why isn't the North like trying to foment that? Or he thinks that is going to take place, especially after John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry, which he's very happy about. So, but then in terms of the U.S., he also talks about slavery, and this is in Capital. This is right in Capital, Volume 1. These couple sentences. In the United States of America, every independent workers' movement was paralyzed as long as slavery disfigured part of the republic. Labor in a white skin cannot emancipate itself where it is branded in a black skin. However, a new life for labor immediately arose from the death of slavery. And then he talks about the first National Labor Congress that was held in 1866 in the United States. Now, this stuff is all fairly well known as a book, Marx and Engels on the Civil War in the United States. It's been in print in English since before I was born. But not everything is in there. And here's something that's not in there. The 1865 address to the American people. There was an address to Lincoln at one point, but this is the address to the American people when the First International has become, you know, pretty much disgusted with the government of the United States. This is when Andrew Johnson is president. So this is the address to the American people, or part of it. Now, Marx didn't write this, but he has certainly approved it and was part of the First International, in which he had tremendous influence. So here's the crucial sentences. Open letter to the people of the United States. Let your citizens of today be declared free and equal without reserve. If you fail to give them citizens' rights while you demand citizens' duties, there will yet remain a struggle for the future which may again stain your country with your people's blood. So that's, you know, pretty stark warning. Okay, the last one I want to talk about is Ireland. Now, these again, most of these writings are collected in a volume, Marx and Engels on Ireland, the Irish Question. Now, most of these collections are based on collections put out in the Soviet Union, assembled there, and then later issued in English by international publishers. For some reason, they never had one of those on Poland. They didn't widely circulate that, and you can think about why that might have been. But Marx's writings on Ireland, especially around 1870, constitute his most theoretically sophisticated and developed discussion of the interweaving of class, nationalism, race, and ethnicity that you could see also in the Poland writings and the writings on the Civil War in America. Now, he and Engels always supported the Irish struggle. From their earliest writings, they support independence for Ireland, they support the Irish nationalist movement, they support the struggle for the rights of Irish workers inside Britain. Now, in the international, there's another fight over Ireland, over one of these kind of political questions, and this is what really people don't, I've never seen anyone else refer to this yet. I've looked, and I haven't seen anyone yet. So it's in my book and detailed there, but the first real fight between Marx and Bakunin is over Ireland. The First International is very involved in Britain in petitions to the Queen, who has the power to pardon, because Irish revolutionaries are in prison and about to be executed. And so they write these petitions, they get labor leaders to sign them, send them to the Queen, pardon or at least don't execute these men. Now, Bakunin's group publishes an attack that says, the working class should not get involved in non-class issues like defense of Irish nationalists, and absolutely should never write a petition to Queen Victoria, because we don't recognize her. Okay. And so Marx thought differently. Marx thought that this issue was intimately connected with the struggle of the British working class. And there's a debate with Bakunin, and Marx wrote, in the context of that debate, he writes one of his most interesting conceptualizations of the relationship of ethnicity, of ethnic oppression, to class consciousness, and so forth. Now, he indicates also that he's changed his position. He used to think that Britain would have a revolution by the workers, and then they would free Ireland. But now he says he's reversing his position. I've become more and more convinced. And the thing now is to drum this conviction into the English working class, that they will never do anything decisive here in England before they separate their attitude towards Ireland quite definitely from that of the ruling classes and make common cause with the Irish. Every movement in England itself is crippled by the dissension with the Irish, who form a very important section of the working class in England itself. Then he goes on, elsewhere he writes, that English working class consciousness was attenuated by anti-Irish prejudice. The common English worker, he writes, hates the Irish worker as a competitor who lowers wages and the standard of life. Think also of immigrant labor at this time. He views him similarly to how the poor whites of the southern states of North America viewed black slaves. This antagonism among the proletarians of England is artificially nourished and kept up by the bourgeoisie. It knows that this split is the true secret of the preservation of his power, and even does a little cultural critique. He says you can find that in the comic strips, in the newspapers. Moreover, the Irish independence struggle, he writes, could be the lever, this is in the polemic with Bakunin, could be the lever that would pry apart British and thus global capitalism. Here's what he writes. Although revolutionary initiative will probably come from France, England alone can serve as a lever for a serious economic revolution. It is the only country where the capitalist form, that is to say, combined labor on a large scale, under the authority of capitalists, has seized hold of almost the whole of production. The English have all the material conditions for social revolution. What they lack is a sense of generalization and revolutionary passion. It is only the General Council of the International that can provide them with this, that can thus accelerate the truly revolutionary movement in this country and consequently everywhere. If England is the bulwark of landlordism and European capitalism, the only place where official England can be struck a great blow is Ireland. This referred to Ireland's revolutionary peasantry, whose opposition to the system, he felt, was enhanced by a national factor. In other words, peasants everywhere probably hate their landlords, but in this case, it's a British landlord who's trying to impose Protestantism, like not just Protestantism, the Anglican Church, on them, and having laws are discriminating, or there are laws of religious discrimination. Ireland is also where the landed aristocracy, part of the British ruling class, because he always sees it as both landlords and capitalists, had important holdings. In other words, they had holdings in Ireland as well as England very often. So, conclusion. I've tried to show that Marx's critique of capital was far broader than is usually supposed. To be sure, he concentrated on the labor-capital relation within Western Europe and North America. I'm not saying you should read only my book if you want an introduction to Marx. But at the same time, he expended considerable time and energy on the analysis of non-Western societies as well as race, ethnicity, and nationalism in Western Europe and North America. These are also problems of our time, and it behooves us not only to stop attacking Marx for allegedly ignoring them, but also to see what we can learn from the ways in which he never separated these issues from the critique of capital, and at the same time took each of them seriously as social factors. So, a couple general comments for today. One could say that he began with a somewhat one-sided appreciation of capitalist modernity, of its progressiveness, but that he moved away from that toward a harsher critique of modernity. Now, you can see this not only in his writings in India, you can see his writings on labor and capital in England. This is a really strange thing to say, but he didn't really know that much about capitalism when he wrote the Communist Manifesto. He never even lived in an advanced capitalist country. He moved to England in 1849. The Communist Manifesto has a lot of appreciation of capitalist progress. The Grundrisse, even, 10 years later, has appreciation. You don't find praise of its progress in the same explicit way, but he says, you know, they're kind of developing the productive forces, and the workers will take that over eventually. But in Capital, there's much less of that language in 1867 and later. The critique of capitalism actually becomes harsher, I would argue, in the book Capital. Commodity fetishism in Capital. Human relations are as relations between things, not because this is falsified, but because this is what they really are under modern capital. That's an incredibly harsh critique. It's also true of the chapter on machinery, where he argues that the most modern forms of technology, as of his time, served to deepen both the exploitation and the alienation of the worker, did not bring progress for the worker. So implications for today, though, of like what I was talking about earlier, you know, the ethnicity, nationalism, and non-Western societies in his writings on that. Okay, first of all, at a general level, Marx's dialectic is not as abstractly universal as a lot of people think, as abstractly universalistic, but has more room than is usually realized for particulars and specifics like nation, ethnicity, and race. Second, Marx's late writings especially theorize indigenous forms of resistance to capital, as we can see in places like Chiapas or Bolivia today, and he also theorizes their need to connect to urban working class movements in more developed sectors or more developed countries. Now, I don't think these have the same force they did in 1880 because the world has become more urbanized and much more developed, and capital has penetrated much further into every pore of society in every part of the world. Nonetheless, it still has some relevance. Thirdly, these discussions of race and ethnicity and in relation to class in Ireland, I mean, I don't think I have to spell out the relation to the urban ghettos of the United States or to France, those kind of ghettos that they have where we saw an uprising just a few years ago. I think that part is clearly quite relevant to us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ben. So, it's our time to get into questions and discussion. Give people a moment to catch their breath here. Yes, all the way back to there.
We have books for sale from Blue Stockings, Overcoming the Iranian Revolution, Gender and Seduction of it. Your books.
Who's the author? Oh, thank you.
Kevin B. Anderson.
Cool. Thank you.
And the Rosa Luxemburg Reader. So we have like three copies of these and five of these, and we take credit and cash. So buy them so I don't have to carry them.
Okay.
They're really good. I was reading them.
That's a personal recommendation.
Yes.
Can you tell me specifically where Marx critiques the slave insurrections in the American South, and particularly the John Brown's insurrection?
Oh, it's what's in that book, The Civil War, Marx and Engels on the Civil War in the United States. It's a letter to Engels right at the time, like, what is that, December 1859. And what's interesting about the letter is he also talks about the Russian peasantry. He says there's two great things happening in the world today. One is the unrest among the Russian peasants, and the other is the possibility of a slave revolution in America. And he's talking a little loosely. He says a slave revolution may be also in Russia. Those are his words. That letter is pretty easily found. And there's other places in his early writings, the first period of his writings on the Civil War, because they had these, Lincoln got really scared by this and put a stop to it, but they had the Kansas Jayhawkers, as they were called. That's what John Brown called himself. So they were going down, they were taking units that, with white officers and black troops, and going in and basically, conducting harassment, going in and burning down slave plantations and just showing, that they could operate in all the, even though they were, had seceded, that, the armed force of the North was going to be around. And some of that's captured, actually, if you saw the film Glory, it's captured, but it's not portrayed very positively. And so he writes about that, too, that maybe he's too optimistic in his terms. He thinks that maybe this could spark a slave revolution in the South.
Yes?
Yeah, about with the possibility of an alternative path of development in Russia. This was, of course, the way the populists argued, that Marxism was valid for the West, but the ancient Russian peasant commune, the Mir, could provide the basis for direct passage to socialism. And at one point, Marx seems to suggest that he also agrees with this possible, agrees that this is possible.
Right.
But this is the treatment that I I've seen of this. I mean, I also read Marx's letters to Patton and so forth. Who was a populist conspirator. But the treatment, the main treatment that I've seen of this is by Perry Anderson, which is not very sympathetic. He says that Marx had a blind spot when it came to Russia, due to the fact that they intervened against the revolution of 1848, and that this sympathy for populism was something which Engels later had to correct, to the effect that indeed a stage of capitalist development was necessary for Russia, and this, of course, was very important to Russian Marxism at its founding, its battle against the populists. So, right. How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I think I'm more familiar with the debate from the other end, because I know by Perry Anderson's stuff, but you know, in the U.S., there was this book that came out about 25 years ago, Marx and the Russian Road, edited by Theodore Chanin with Monthly Review Press. I think a number of people in the room probably are aware of that. That book almost makes Marx into a left populist. So there's that argument that's been out there as well. So let me just deal with both of those quickly. Perry Anderson, he is unhappy with what Marx says about Russia. He's unhappy with the notion of the Asiatic mode of production, which he says we should lay to rest. And he states in a, what is that, the first passages to modernity, what is that?
It's the interest of the absolute state.
Yeah, he says in there that fortunately Marx doesn't refer to the Asiatic mode of production in Capital, that he drops it by that time. But that's not true. Right in the fetishism section of chapter one of Capital, it's right there. He also dislikes Marx's attitude toward Russia, both at the beginning, where Marx thinks of Russia kind of the way Latin American revolutionaries think of the American CIA. I mean, Russia is just, as you remember, the counter-revolutionary power par excellence. It's trying everywhere, even outside its borders, to undermine the revolutionaries. When one of his articles isn't published in the Tribune, he sometimes thinks that Russian agents have like bribed them to not publish it, especially if it's a critique of Russia. He accuses British politicians, prominent ones, of being in the pay of Russia. It gets rather overblown, and Perry Anderson is correct to call these writing overblown. Later on, when he shifts his attitude toward Russia, it becomes this sympathy for the villager and this village-based resistance. But I want to say that there's a difference with populism also. It isn't a left populism for a couple reasons. First of all, the populists tend to romanticize the village. Marx is not interested in preserving the village. He sees it as a locus of resistance, but he wants the village to be modernized, but just not under the coercive form of Western capitalism. Secondly, more importantly, I think it's a clearer difference, the populists believe in autarky. They, like the Maoists later, thought that you could construct socialism in Russia, or Stalin later. In other words, yeah. In other words, Marx is very clear that he doesn't, a poor agricultural country like Russia, he doesn't think can develop socialism. He says that can be the starting point for a communist development, resistance based on those communal forms, if it links up with the working class movement in the developed countries. He's not interested in Russia breaking off and by itself becoming what the populist version of socialism is. I don't see any evidence of that in his writings.
Yes.
Does that include his letter of 1878?
Tell us more about which letter you're talking about.
What?
The 1877 letter?
That might be the year. I thought it was 1878. Where he says the forces most ripe for revolution in the world are the Russian peasants.
Right. He says that kind of thing frequently.
Yeah,
But that was a distinct response to the accusation that he was waiting for industrial global revolution.
Right. Yeah, I talked about right. That was a letter I talked about before, where he denies that he has a general historical philosophical theory for all countries in all times. But no, he doesn't there. He says that if Russia allows itself to follow, I think it's a quote, this quote is almost exactly this, if Russia allows itself to be drawn in to the net of Western capitalism, it will lose the finest chance ever offered by a people, something like that. But he isn't saying that, there's nowhere that he says they're going to do it on their own. He wants them to resist capital, but he's an internationalist. I don't think he thought the Irish either have a much more developed economy. He's not talking about them breaking off on their own, being able to set up socialism in any kind of positive sense. Because don't forget, from the earliest days, like in the manuscripts of 1844, there's that critique of crude communism, which he says is just leveling down to the bare minimum, a type of equality that is a leveling down, poverty for everyone. Everyone being a worker, an industrial worker. He's consistently in his work antagonistic to that type of notion. But this is a hotly this is a hotly contested territory, and we could have a whole evening just on Marx's writings on Russia and the various permutations of that. And Perry Anderson has a different view. This guy Teodor Shanin. I mean, if you want a view that kind of thinks more in terms of Russia going on its own, this book I mentioned before, Marx and the Russian Road, you can get a view a little bit different from what I've been arguing.
You just have to be careful that the developments in the Soviet Union after that point have been used by many leftists to negate the existence of socialism. In other words, negate the fact that there was no capital accumulation for 70 years. And that's what Marx premises in his writings, that the peasants had an opportunity to begin negating the existence of capital accumulation and private property existence.
Right, right.
Even in their primitive state.
But what the Russian, by Lenin's generation, what they were partly aware of these writings, and frankly they rejected them. But what they said, and Rosa Luxemburg was the only one who said it, the one who said it the most explicitly, was things have changed so much that we can't hold to Marx's old positions. That's how they. But they were Rosa Luxemburg, Lenin, Trotsky. These people were much more uncritical modernists than Marx himself was.
Yes.
One being, it tells a little bit more. I think you mentioned that some of his notebook writings on different struggles in what we would guess call now the developing world, when that will come out, or a little bit about that project.
Two,
I'm not wording this very well, probably, but with China or how things played out, like it seems to me, without having as much of an understanding as you, obviously. But in regards to where revolutions actually happened under the name of at least Marxism, have been in places where it seems to me that it's been where capitalism has had its weakest link. And so I'm curious about, as much as I would want to uphold Marx, at the same time, is it actually true? Has it happened where, why hasn't it happened where there could be the link up with the working class in the developed countries? Because it doesn't seem like it's happen. It doesn't mean that therefore that's wrong, but I'm curious about when one's faced with a situation where you have socialist revolutionaries or Marxists and they're able to make a revolution in a country that's largely, or a place, let's say, that is under development, what do? And how do they, I know that's been the major debate, but is it always just one way or the other, or is there some type of way of bridging that?
Yeah, okay, the first question, the bibliographic question. Some of these writings are in English right now. There's a book, The Asiatic Mode of Production by Lawrence Crater, in its appendix. You can find some of these writings on India and also Algeria, which I didn't talk about, these late notebooks. There's a book called The Ethnological Notebooks of Karl Marx, which was published 25 or so years ago. That's in a mixture of German and English. For over 10 years, Professor David Smith has been readying a translation of that, but it's been a very slow process. That's supposed to come out one of these days from Yale University Press. I'm involved in a project to publish a bunch more, to republish some of that stuff in a better way, and also publish some additional stuff. At the end of his life, he was actually looking at three pre-capitalist societies in great detail. Ancient Rome, he wrote a lot about. India and Russia. And what he's looking at, I think, in each of these, is what the form of the transition is going to be, and does it really have to take the same form? And in that letter of 1877 we were talking about before, there's a very interesting sentence. He says, well, a lot of people think that Russia will therefore go the same way, but look at ancient Rome. They urbanized, they expropriated their peasantry, they replaced that by slave labor, and they drove them into the cities to become a proletariat. But there was no revolution, because the proletarians couldn't, and he doesn't develop all this here, but in the other notebooks he develops, the proletarians couldn't, they were the bread and circuses people, and the slaves were doing the real work. And then this is what I found really interesting. In his notebooks he says, like the poor whites of the South, he says the poor whites, these Roman proletarians. So he's making that connection with race. Now, okay, so that takes us to the other question. There's a lot of reasons that we could talk about why that didn't happen, and the working class and radical movements of the West were again and again unsuccessful, though again, it was contingent. I mean, at the end of World War I, in places like Germany and Italy, I mean, it got pretty close. In 68, in a number of countries, it got close. We're coming into a huge crisis right now. Initially, sentiment seems to be more to the right than to the left, but it doesn't mean that would be permanent. And I think what I'm interested in is the ideological barrier, viewing established Marxism a little bit as an ideology. I mean, clearly in the Soviet Union it was an ideology, but even, in other words, Marxism, which I think is the most interesting and valid and accurate portrayal of capitalism and of the pathway towards socialism, they haven't grasped this side of Marx and Marxism. And it's not only, I mean, other people, there are others besides Marx. I mean, Engels has some very good stuff on some of these questions, not all of them. Lenin, I wrote a book on Lenin, and one of the chapters in there is on the colonial and national questions and so on. So there is a tradition there, but it's not the dominant tradition. And I think with the eyes of the 21st century, I think with any thinker who's worth reading, not just as a classic, but as a thinker that maybe is valid, we have to re-examine them. If they're a really important thinker, we should be able to reread them and grasp things that we hadn't grasped before based on the times that we're living in. I mean, how many people in the 18th century were looking at the discussion of women's equality, Plato's Republic, where he said that women could do everything, including becoming generals? I don't think that in the Catholic universities or, you know, the British public schools, that they were emphasizing that part of Plato when there weren't even any women around as part of the discussion.
I can go again if nobody else wants.
Sure.
But as far as colonialism is concerned, you say that Marx initially has a linear view. With that Europe showed colonial countries the image of its future and then came to change that. But I'm wondering what the later view of colonialism was, and if he had a completed view of that, or whether it had to wait until later to be developed. It seems to me that the first theory that I know of that puts forward a distinctly different view is Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution
which says that the capitalist development of Russia does not necessarily lead to, you know, the universal capitalist development of the society, but that foreign capital that invests there wants to keep its, wants to ensure the safety of its property, and therefore actually props up the Tsarist states and all of the backward relations of the society. And so rather than develop the society, this is what colonialism does. Marx, as far as I, you know, as far as I know, never reached such a systematic, or, you know, view of colonialism. But that seems to be closer to the one we have today.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Or three things. First of all, what's interesting about Marx is, yeah, he doesn't have that. I mean, these are notebooks, so we don't know what he would have done with them. Was there aren't like finished essays even that much about India. But he's much more concerned, seemingly, with the internal structure of these societies under the impact of colonialism and capitalist penetration. Whereas if you read Lenin or Trotsky, it's about the global capital, especially like a book like Lenin's Imperialism, global capitalism, finance capitalism, and so forth. He talks in general about Indian resistance, and we need to support this, anti-imperialism, and so forth. But he doesn't talk in any detail about Chinese society or Indian society, except insofar as they're dominated by global capital. He kind of sees their ruling classes as instruments of the global imperialist system. Okay. So that's a difference, and it's an interesting difference. Secondly, Trotsky, I mean, I think Trotsky is very prescient in, what is that, 1904 or 5, what we were talking about. In one of those writings later on, Trotsky actually, because you said this thing, the image of its own future. This is another sentence that's quoted. This is from the preface to Capital, that those societies which are more developed show to the less developed the image of its own future. Even though it's the preface, he cheated. And in the French edition of Capital, even though this is the German preface being translated, it has the date 1867, he adds a line. You're not supposed to do that. You know, you're supposed, you know, because it doesn't, he doesn't say, you know, I would like to add this. He just slips it in. For those countries that have embarked upon the process of capitalist industrialization. So he makes very clear that he's talking about Germany, which is about to embark on that, leaving India and so forth aside. And Theodore Chanin, in this book, Marx and the Russian Road, attacks Marx for this sentence, unaware that Marx altered it. Trotsky is very creative in the way he uses it. Trotsky says, well, the image of its own future, like any dialectical proposition, you can reverse it. So I'm going to reverse it. Under certain conditions, this will reverse. And so the less developed country carries the image of its own future to the more developed. But the flaw there's a number of flaws we could talk about with Trotsky, but one of them is, of course, the peasantry. Trotsky is not very interested in the peasantry, has almost not as awful as Kautsky's position about the peasantry, but kind of sees the peasantry as, you know, a group that's bound to disappear, doesn't really have much of a revolutionary consciousness. It's unclear if it can develop one. And that's quite different from Marx's position or Lenin's position. I know the Stalinists exaggerated this and so on for their own partisan purposes. But I mean, you read Trotsky's articles on China. I maybe haven't read them as well as you have. And the Chinese Revolution is a peasant-based revolution, and there just isn't a real grasp of that. By Trotsky, and frankly, I mean, there are some exceptions, but those writing in that, I mean, like people like Michael Lowy, but a lot of the people in the Trotskyist tradition had trouble with that. I mean, you could say that, well, it doesn't matter anymore because the peasantry has receded, and now we do have urbanization, even in most of the global south. Anyway, my 2 cents on Trotsky.
Looks like,
given Marx's denial that there is a general historical trajectory that needs to be followed, how can we read the tendency for a correlation between anti-colonial struggles today and socialist struggles, such as in Cuba, where we see anti-colonialism kind of going hand in hand with a socialist revolutionary program, and maybe kind of what you just pointed out about Trotsky's argument that less developed countries can bear the image of a future for more developed countries, how that maybe reflects.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think all those revolutions of the 1950s, I mean, even the 40s with India, and the Indian independence struggle, not quite a revolution, but certainly the Chinese Revolution of 49, up through, you know, Chiapas and that kind of stuff happening, Bolivia now, yeah, this is clearly, I mean, it's unquestionably where the locus of the most important revolutionary movements have been in those parts of the world. They've often had a socialist coloration. Of course, the book on Foucault and the Iranian Revolution writes about a place where they didn't have a socialist coloration, or at least the dominant wing wasn't. And that's a whole. So yeah, that, you know, whether that now you could say that maybe that process has also reached an impasse or an end. In other words, there's not as many. I mean, the crisis of the left is not just in the U.S. and the developed countries. The crisis of the left is in Latin America, Africa, and South Asia as well. It's a very deep crisis, and part of it is that regimes came to power in a number of countries, and they couldn't really develop a good socialist society either. And the claim of most of these movements was a socialism in one country type of claim that didn't work out. And if I can just plug the other book for a second, Foucault in the Iranian Revolution argues that the exhaustion of the socialist movement creates a political space because people still are dissatisfied and in fact enraged about imperial domination of their society. So in the Middle Eastern and Muslim world, this has created the collapse and crisis of the socialist and Marxist movement has created space in which the Islamist movement has stepped in. And some in the Western left don't want to, you know, recognize that that's a problem enough. I mean, I don't think anyone, I've never heard anyone on the left say, like, I'm happy that Islamists are now running the resistance to imperialism instead of socialists. Michel Foucault came close, though, but he's not a typical representative of the left.
Yes.
Well, Villa-Bejie would at least give him 50% of the blame for the destruction of communist, socialist, anti-imperialist movements.
Who would?
Villa-Bejie. You're familiar with his perspective?
Yeah, Villa-Bejie, the guy who wrote the book on the CIA.
Right.
Yeah.
To the annihilation of anti-imperialist movements and forces.
Sure.
That left the vacuum for Islamic fundamentalism.
But there's different ways to be annihilated. Okay, if you're annihilated the way the new Jubilee of Grenada was, where, like, the revolutionaries turn on themselves, kill each other, and then that leaves an opening for U.S. imperialism to come in, and the CIA, what was I'm sure was around, you know, the whole time from beginning to end, that's a different kind of defeat, which then just leaves nothing positive in its wake, than, say, the defeat of the Paris Commune, where they don't have it. You can't say, oh, they did these awful things. They were, you know, they were taking their critics and lining them up and shooting them and so on, and then that's how they lost popular support, and then the reactionaries came in and conquered. I mean, when you can have a defeat, but that still is a positive legacy for the future, or you can have a defeat, which is also an ideological collapse of your movement. And we've had a lot of that second type of defeat.
Maybe this would be a good time to thank Kevin for his terrific presentation. Oh, I'm sorry, Russell.
Well, we have time.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because Kevin mentioned a couple of times Engels' view on some of these things. It strikes me that the 20th century revolutions like China and India were important examples of some of the things that Marx was looking at in his last writings, Kevin think shows clearly enough. But it seems like there was a link that was broken between what Marx had developed on both Western capitalism and non-Western societies with the death of Marx, even though Engels himself wrote Origins of the Family, Private Property and the State as his first work after Marx's death, taking up some of these later writings of Marx. And yet, we didn't have any continuity from Marx, because there's a question, I think, of whether Engels' interpretation of what Marx was doing was accurate, and whether the Marxists we learned from Engels were really learning the dialect that Marx had developed at Heaven, especially things like some of the gender issues.
Yeah, there's a whole, in my book, I didn't go into it tonight, but there's a whole step-by-step assessment of Engels in comparison to Marx, and on all the topics I addressed, there are contributions, just about all of them, there are contributions by Engels, and as Russell was saying, Engels looks at these notes that are on Algeria, India, also Native Americans, ancient Romans, so forth, and he writes the famous book, Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State. He seems to think that what Marx was involved in this research was figuring out the origins of class society, what later became exploitation, gender oppression, because there is a lot about gender in some of those writings. And there's a couple problems. One is that Engels is very schematic. In other words, gender oppression begins at the point where private property and the state come into being. And the implicit conclusion of that is that the way to fight against women's oppression is to fight against private property capital in the state. But there's also the problem that Engels didn't see colonialism in the same way that Marx was. I mean, he did oppose the British and the Sepoy uprising. Engels lived much longer. He lived 12 years after Marx's death. Imperialism was much more consolidated as a global system by the time that Engels died. There isn't any effort on his part to really think this through. He gets Marx's notes on Indonesia, Java, that haven't been published yet, and he writes a letter to Kautsky where he doesn't seem to grasp very well what Marx is about in these notes, and he doesn't take a clear public anti-colonialist position. I mean, he doesn't support colonialism, but he doesn't suggest that anti-colonialism should be a major point in the workers' movement. Really quickly, some of the other, because I don't want to be bashing Engels entirely. On Ireland, he has some really great writings. On Poland, when Marx is trying to answer the Proudhonists, he turns to Engels to write it, and he writes an essay called What Does the Working Class Have to Do with Poland, where he argues for the need for the working classes to support this national movement. Civil War in the United States, a lot of the writings that appear under Marx's name are actually written by Engels, especially the military analysis. But there are disagreements. Like, Engels takes a little bit of a technological, military strategy type approach to the Civil War. And Engels constantly thinks the North is going to lose till very late in the war, because the South has the better military training, and they're initially more enthusiastic about the war, and so on. So it's a mixed bag, and I think on dialectics, Engels is his popularizations aren't really that haven't been that helpful. But it's a mixed bag, and I don't agree with Sartre that too bad about that unfortunate meeting with Engels in 1844. I don't agree with that statement.
For no other reason that Engels helped him out financially to a considerable extent, allowed him to do his writing and his research. Do we have any other questions or comments?
Yeah.
So let's give Kevin a big round of applause.
Thank you. Well, thanks for setting it up, inviting me. Thank you.
Listen, thanks. Thanks really.